Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Malcolm Frank is the Executive Vice President of Strategy and Marketing at Cognizant, a leading business and technology consulting firm with over 175,000 employees. He has over 25 years of experience consulting on IT-based strategy with organizations around the world. His co-authors on this book are Paul Roerig and Ben Pring. Malcolm, the title of the book is Code Halos: How the Digital Lives of People, Things, and Organizations Are Changing the Rules of Business. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What's a code halo?
A code halo is the virtual you. So we all have one. Some of us recognize it, some of us don't. But obviously there's the physical you. I can see you, see what you look like, start to make some assumptions based on that. But in the last 5-10 years, as all of us are living our virtual lives, we're going online and shopping on Amazon, we're building our friends' networks on Facebook, professional ones on LinkedIn, so forth and so on. Every time we go online, every time we use our smartphone or our tablet, go on the internet, we're leaving clues about ourselves and we're starting to create a digital self. And we call it a code halo because first, it's a halo. It's always around you. But secondly, the code has two meanings. One is it's technical. There's physical code, data. But also, more importantly, it is almost like DNA. It is the true you. It's your true self. And in many ways, what's fascinating, and folks are starting to recognize this, when you want to pick a movie on Saturday evening, Netflix and their Cinematch engine may understand that a lot better than your spouse will. And when you're looking for that next book that you want to read on vacation, Amazon recognizes your tastes in authors and your tastes in literature better than your brother. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that we think has profound impact both on individuals, on society, and on how a lot of industry structures stand and are changing in the future.
How can a less than high-tech company benefit from the advice in this book?
That's a great question, because this started with the usual suspects, with Pandora, Netflix, Google, Amazon, Facebook. And I saw this in my consulting travels, almost a wall of denial about 2-3 years ago. I'd meet with banking executives or executives at manufacturers, and they'd say, yeah, that's interesting. I understand what happened at Borders. I understand what happened at Blockbuster, but that's a movie thing. That's a book thing. We're different. Well, no, they aren't. And it turns out that these tech companies were the canaries in the coal mine. They built these digital business models. They've set a new customer expectation. But now it's a universal expectation. We hear things like people saying, why is it that my $300 smartphone is so smart and yet my $30,000 car is so stupid? Why is it that when I go to Amazon, they really understand who I am, and then I walk into the retail branch of a bank and it's a truly alienating experience? I've been there 20 years. They don't know who I am. I go to the ATM and the first question is Spanish or English. And so I think it's this new customer expectation that has been started with these digital firms is now the way that people want all of these other organizations to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And those that understand that, I think, will do well, and those that don't could start to run into trouble.
What is the SMAC stack, and why should company leadership be concerned with it?
Yeah, the SMAC stack is our acronym for the new technology model. We've all been working with it in our personal lives, and now it's coming into the corporation at an incredible rate. So the acronym is S is for social technologies like we see with Facebook and other platforms. The M is for mobile and mobility, and obviously that's exploded, and all of us are leading highly mobile computing lives. The third is with analytics and the advanced analytics and the data science that is behind all of this. So how does Netflix really understand what you're looking for, what mood you're in on a Sunday evening? That's through their data science and working through the mountains of big data to make meaning out of that, to make sense out of the noise. And then the C is the cloud that has to host all of these. We saw that several folks were talking about these piece parts of that technology. So some folks would run around and say, oh, everything's moving to the cloud, or mobility is the future. And we found that actually to be quite limiting. This architecture, these four pieces fit together like Lego blocks, and it's hard to implement one without the other. So when you go into a corporate environment, corporations have been running their technology in an architecture for about the last 20 years that in tech circles we call client server, or it's the Wintel, the Windows and Intel architecture, and we glued the internet on top of that. That's been a dominant computing architecture in most corporations for 20 years. But now they need to get smart on this new one and have the SMAC model fit in with the old Wintel model to create these new experiences that firms like Facebook and Amazon have been able to create.
Does every company need a Kindle or a Fuel Band?
No. We find a Code Halo has many elements to it. One element in what you're talking about is what we call an amplifier.
It's like a dedicated piece of technology.
Correct.
A special, almost special purpose piece of enabling technology.
Yeah, exactly. And in some cases you need it, some cases you don't. So there are a lot of cases where you can use what you already have. Mm-hmm. It's the BYOD, bring your own device. So mm-hmm. in many cases, that's already going to be what the consumer has in terms of their iPad, their smartphone, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So retail banks that want to get into this world, they don't have to build a device. The device is already there. We're working with some hospitals where they want to completely transform the stay of the patient. So instead of ringing the bell, asking for the nurse, they can sit in their bed, have their iPad, and just say, I need crushed ice, or I'm in moderate pain, or I need help with XYZ, and really starts to change things. So you can see in those scenarios, the infrastructure is there. But in other cases, particularly in the industrial world, some companies are having to build their own devices. Mm-hmm. A good example is Disney. They've mm-hmm. created the Magic Band for their parks, so the park can be transformed from this one-to-many experience to a truly curated one-to-one experience. So it's a device. It's a wristband that they'll send to you, and you wear it when you walk around the park, and it helps you with your stay. We're also seeing this with the Internet of Things. Auto manufacturers want to build code halos around the car and around the driver, but they have to instrument the car to do that. So they have to get the right technologies to put in the dashboard, to put on the transmission, on the engine, so forth and so on. So it really depends on the case. Sometimes the infrastructure's there, and sometimes firms do have to create their own platform.
I think it was either last Sunday or the Sunday before on 60 Minutes, a story came up, and it was one of the stories they're famous for, presenting the deep, dark side of some kind of corporate business undertaking. I think it was the story was called Data Brokers. And it leads me to my next question. It sort of painted this picture of the seamy underbelly of you're being watched everywhere you go and people are tracking you and your business on the internet and personal information about you. And I find it interesting that you have a chapter in the book entitled Don't Be Evil. So who or what is evil?
You were really getting onto that. Corporations and governments now have completely new levels of insight and knowledge on customers and citizens. And we think trust is going to be the currency of this new virtual economy. There's some folks that say, hey, you know, let's stop this. It's all too frightening. Let's go back. I don't think that's the case. That's not going to happen.
They managed to get over the creepy hill. The creepy hill is there, and you approach the creepy hill, and it gets creepy. You know what I mean? What do you know about me? How did you find out this about me? But what do I get in return? And you kind of get over that hill. But I think you make a very good case in the book for a company who's involved in that, for taking that on head on and confronting it and not denying it, but saying it's a part of doing business. It's one of the things you're going to have to be very transparent about and very upfront about. I also thought it was interesting. You give a little mini case study in the book where you say, here's a customer, and not only does she want to switch to a competitor or a different credit card or something like that, she wants all of her information that you've ever tracked on her to them. And the reporter in the story, on the 60 Minutes story, went to one of the, like, CEO of one of these data broker companies and someone who was bold enough to actually sit in front of a 60 Minutes camera. And the reporter asked the CEO, so can I see all the information that you have on me? And he goes, well, we can show you the types of information. And I thought, boy, that's a dodge.
That's right. That's right. And that's an organization that if they continue with that behavior, they're going to be outed. They're going to be shamed. I think they're going to start to lose customers and potentially go out of business. We think that that is absolutely the behavior that firms should not engage in. So with this, we do outline a few steps. One is with customers, you have to allow them to opt in. So as an example, let's say I buy my next car and it really is a truly smart car. Well, with that, they can start to recognize where I drive, how I drive, where I've been. Now, I may think, hey, there's tremendous benefit with that, and so I want to have that. Mm-hmm. Other car owners may say, "Woo, oh, no, 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 that's really creepy. I don't like that at all." So I think there's an opt-in. where some customers can say, I want to give this information and receive the benefits of the driving experience. And others are going to say, no, I want to work with this car in complete anonymity. So I think there's an opt-in, number one. Number two, as you said with that case study, let's say that somebody does opt in for a couple of years and they go, you know what, I don't like this, or I just want to move to a different provider or whatever it may be. That firm should give back all of the data, and we think that's very important. And it's not publicized enough, but firms like Google and Amazon are already starting to do that.
I think they should just, overall, everyone should just be much more upfront about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to calm people down.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It's a trust thing.
Exactly. Exactly. It is a trust thing. And society needs to navigate through this, meaning that information, who truly owns it? So when I interact with that institution, is it their information or is it mine as an individual and as a consumer? And we move quite strongly to it should belong to the individual and it should belong to the consumer. In fact, I think there's a wonderful business model out there that's yet to come to the fore, but if somebody could create a platform by which you could just control your own code halo,
yep,
and just like a key, say, I'll insert that key with this organization.
I'll
share it with you.
Right.
And at the same time, I can take it back whenever I want and have that portability. And the third thing you touched upon, this is the creepy factor that you go to Pandora, for example, and you think, hey, I'm just giving them my musical tastes. You know, what's the harm? You know, shocker. Somebody finds out Malcolm likes Led Zeppelin.
Mm-hmm.
Who cares? But they can now start to recognize, for example, how you vote based upon your musical tastes or how you feel about certain social issues based on your musical taste. Now, do you want that out there?
Right.
Do you want that sold to folks? And there was a case in Minnesota with a large retailer where the retailer had figured out a teenage girl was pregnant.
Yes. Classic story that appeared in a New York Times article, and it was in Charles Duhigg's book Habit as well. And the coupons for baby products came to the house. The father of that girl was enraged, and he contacted the retailer, and he complained, and apparently he came back a week later, and he said, you were right. Sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
That is creepy.
That is creepy, but it raises the point, and this is back to your 60 Minutes story, that if that consumer comes back and says, time out, you know a lot more about me than I thought you did, and I want to understand how and why, we think it's incumbent upon firms to share that. They don't have to hand over the code and show their algorithms, but they should be reasonably transparent.
There should be, don't you think? There should be some way of doing that, which leads to my next question. Why do you consider algorithms to be a code halo business's secret sauce?
Yeah, they are the secret sauce. I'll start with just the data, which is the raw materials, if you will, of this world. According to IDC and others, we're living through a decade where data is just absolutely exploding. So for most corporations, by 2020, they're going to be managing 50 times the data they were managing in 2011. And you hear these stats where 90% of all the data in the world is only created in the last 24 months.
Yeah.
So we're living through this time of data explosion. The difference is what firms can make meaning out of that, can determine, okay, of all of these elements, the important ones are to pick A and combine it with G and a little bit of N. And when I put those together the right way, I can really figure out what's going on with my customers or what's going on in my market.
Mm-hmm.
That's meaning making, and that's the data science or the algorithms that are behind that. So when we look at this virtual competitive landscape, a lot of things can be replicated. So you talked about the devices or the amplifiers. Those can be replicated pretty fast, and they commoditize very quickly. We see that with mobile phones. We see that with wearables and the rest. In terms of getting your arms around the data, most firms, you know, Bank A is going to get basically the same data that Bank B gets.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all going to get the same data, and they've got access to all the same technology tools.
Mm-hmm.
So what makes or breaks companies is, do they have those very rare human beings, those data scientists who understand the technology, understand the data, are very good with math, and then also understand the business context.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's a tough combination, but that's where you say algorithms are forever.
That's kind of where the magic happens.
That is where the magic happens.
Is that also why, you mentioned in the book, is that also why many of these firms are really doing some heavy recruiting of social scientists now?
Yes.
Because that's part of the filter.
Right? It is part of the filter. And it's interesting. A lot of firms think, ooh, this is new. Actually, it's quite old, and it's so old they forgot about it.
Yeah.
So if they're a big box retailer, like a Macy's or a Nordstrom's or some platform like that, they figured out the social science of how does somebody walk through the big store. Mm-hmm. It's almost forgotten. When you walk in the mall, you walk in the front, and all of a sudden, there's a woman's perfume counter there. First thing you see. Well, there are very strong psychological reasons that that's there. So they understand that in the physical world, but now they need to come up to speed in understanding how do people behave in the virtual world.
Right.
And so this is where these skills are needed to close that gap.
After making a case for technical rigor and big data in the book, you spend a fair amount of time on the concept of beautiful products and magical user experiences. Do most companies have a problem making that leap?
Yes. Big problem. I'll just start with the starting point. In many cases, this is given to the IT department to solve. If you go inside most Fortune 500 companies and ask the user base, are your systems beautiful? They'll look at you and think, is that a trick question? I would never accuse my email system or my ERP system of being beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's a growth area for a lot of technology departments. But we have found that the bar has been raised of what the team at Apple so famously did in creating mm-hmm. what is truly a beautiful product. But then also you see, for example, Nest. It's a wonderful example of turning this ugly, strange device that's been in our dining rooms all of our lives, of the thermostat, to making it beautiful. And it's not just aesthetically beautiful, but the experience. It's simple, it's intuitive, it's easy. So not only does the Nest look a lot better on the wall, but that doesn't really matter. What truly matters is that it's intuitive, it's easy to use, and a homeowner suddenly reconceptualizes, wow, this is the role a thermostat or a smoke detector plays in the home. That's what we mean by things being beautiful.
Can you walk us through a brief description of the Crossroads model?
Yeah, we saw two things in researching the book. One, at the atomic level, was there's a code halo that's now around every person, place, or thing. But then we started trying to answer the question, why did Netflix win and Blockbuster lose? Why did Google have such success over Yahoo? Why didn't platforms like MySpace win as opposed to Facebook? And it became clear that it wasn't just the ability to understand a code halo and start to build them, but then to have a whole business model that supports that. And firms that got it right got these outsized gains. In fact, we researched and found that combined of Apple and Amazon and Google and Facebook, Netflix, Pandora, those six companies generated $1 trillion of market value in just a 10-year window. And yet we saw at the same time this incredible collapse of their competitive set. And it transcended about 12 different industries and about 100 companies, where their market values, once they got into this new arena, would completely collapse by 90% plus in some cases, many bankruptcies. And it was the Crossroads model. We started to diagnose this industry by industry across many companies and saw, wow, there's a pattern, that this is consistent. And it's happened with such consistency, we think it's going to continue to happen going forward.
So it isn't just, as Clayton Christensen might say, it isn't just identifying the disruptor or being the disruptor. It's really having the system, the process, the network, the people in place to make the whole thing complete.
That's right. That's right.
And taking advantage of your moment in time, because first mover is nowhere near the advantage it used to be.
No, no. And people can replicate many portions of something. A good example is with the Zune versus the iPod. If you go back in time, you know, many of us will remember the Zune was actually a better machine in many ways. Better price point, it had video.
Also was the Betamax.
Yeah. But, you know, Apple cracked the whole business model and the whole ecosystem, and with that ecosystem could bring all of the apps and all of the music and just make it a seamless, easy, beautiful experience. And Microsoft, although they had a better machine, had a worse business model and experience, and we saw what happened.
Why is it important for companies who are undertaking a code halo strategy to get the change management aspects right?
Yeah, that's a big issue, and it's the human issue. We run into this all the time. You know, the good news for these firms that we've been talking about, you know, the Silicon Valley firms, they didn't have an infrastructure. They didn't have a culture. So building these code halo business models, you know, they just did it from the ground up, and it was very natural to them. But when you go into a bank that's been around for 100 years, you go into a car manufacturer that's been around for 80 years, there is a lot of legacy there. And it's not just physical legacy, it's also a cultural legacy. Mm-hmm. So you get managers that have reached a certain position and they said, look, I went by it with a playbook for the last 25 years. Mm-hmm. I have a theory of the business. And now that I have that, you're telling me that I'm wrong or I need to rethink portions of that. And that's very hard.
Yeah. It's one of my tongue-in-cheek mottos that everything would be okay if people weren't involved. You know, like I've just come up with this incredible program and this great business process and this awesome organization. Oh, great. You know, now I've got to bring people up to speed and I have to make them ready, willing, and able to make stuff happen. It's amazing. That is always, and I'm on a bit of a soapbox here, but that is, I find, historically been such a major issue. And companies that have addressed that have succeeded. But it's always seems to be an afterthought.
Yeah. But you know,
it's sad, isn't it? I mean,
it is sad. But for the three of us as authors, we've studied the tech world. Ben and Paul have been analysts before they joined Cognizant at Forrester and Gartner, so they were observing the market from that perspective, and I was from my perch. And it helped us in the technology business, this issue of change management, because we have seen so many firms that had everything. You go back, an example would be Digital Equipment Corporation. Mm-hmm. You know, I lived in Boston during their heyday, and they were the it company. And they had everything. They had terrific products, great management depth, a balance sheet, wonderful brand. They had it all. And within 3 years, it was gone. And it wasn't because they didn't see the change coming. I mean, it wasn't because they were asleep at the switch. It was really this cultural issue, this change management issue of how do I maintain what I've done in the past, but make this shift and make it as quickly as the market is demanding of me? And we've seen it in tech many times, and it's pretty well understood in technology circles. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing it go to other industries through this technology shift with Code Halos.
Mm-hmm. And just as a wrap-up question, it's a little bit out of the box here. Is courage or bravery a critical factor when moving through the design, development, and deployment of a Code Halo solution?
Boy, that's a great question. Because for me, I keep those words at a very high bar. I think of courage and bravery of a soldier
People
standing...
People are very fearful, though. I mean, there's so much fear associated with change.
Yes. Yeah. But here's the issue. Do you want to be enacting that change or have it forced upon you? And I think that when people start to frame the question that way, then they want to drive the change through. There's been a lot of denial going on and people thinking this isn't going to occur to me, but when they start to get the data points and the signals that it is, I think that that's when they do have the courage to start to drive the change in their organizations.
If you understand it, you don't fear it.
Right.
We've been speaking to Malcolm Frank. He, along with Paul Roerig and Ben Pring, have authored a great new book entitled Code Halos, How the Digital Lives of People, Things, and Organizations Are Changing the Rules of Business. Malcolm, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
AMA webinars provide 90 minutes of focused how-to instruction and specific solutions for solving your most pressing work issues. For $149, you'll participate in an in-depth course taught by an expert who will answer your questions and guide you through the process a step at a time. For a complete schedule of upcoming AMA webinars, visit our events calendar at amanet.org/events. Here at the AMA, we value your feedback. If you've ever attended any of our webcasts, webinars, or seminars, you've no doubt encountered our feedback surveys. Well, our podcasts are no different. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.